Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a vodcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Today, I'm delighted to welcome a very, very accomplished individual, Mr. Prakash Seshadri of Sea Change Consulting. He's a serial author, prolific writer, nation builder, business strategist, movie consultant, metal conditioning expert, and an avid heartfulness mediator. So Prakash, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Rastosh. Nice being with you.
Thank you. So, you've got a huge amount of different types of experiences, but today let's talk about your avatar as a coach. Let's start with asking you a question. What made you become a coach?
It's a very funny story. Way back in 83, when I had graduated out of college after commerce, corporate secretaryship, my father was already a businessman. So somehow something told me that I need to get into it. Mm-hmm. And a few of our friends, we all brought in those days what you might call as a seed capital, 1,500 rupees each way back in 83, out of my savings, which I'd made from my school days. Mm-hmm. And we pulled it together to get a pharmaceutical dealership out of a local company. Uh-huh. And we burnt all that money. It took about 6 months for us to understand that just jumping into business is not something that anybody can do. Uh-huh. And that you need a lot of help other than finance and ability to market and all that. You need someone who can actually be outside of your business and guide you. And that experience actually... that was the first initial call that I had when I reflect back on my past, is when I understood that there should have been a person who would have guided. Maybe that journey would have been more successful because that made me go back to a job before I again started off again in 92. So in a nutshell, yes, that experience in 83 taught me the importance of an external coach. After all, even Sachin Tendulkar, Virat Kohli, MS Dhoni, they all have coaches, right?
Well said, well said. So, you know, I'm probably older than you. I started my career in 79. And, you know, when I started, coaching was normally done either by a family elder, coaching or mentoring, or by a senior colleague who took a liking for you. Correct. Today, it has become almost formalized and people are paying for it. So I want to understand, why has coaching become so relevant and powerful in the world?
I mean, before directly answering the question, I don't know how many of the viewers might be aware that today coaching is just not a single bucket. There are about seven subdivisions within coaching, and each one has expertise, and there are programs, there are masters which are running to make you capable of offering, right from finance to emotional to spiritual and all that. Today, if you really look at the microscopic scan that you get through the social media and stuff like that, the need for a person specifically at the top level, whether you're an entrepreneur or a son taking over from the father, the big empire or whatever, the need to perform from day one is really immense. In fact, last week I met a very big group's son, and he was saying that I have a huge pressure. He's just about 23, graduated out of a foreign MBA course. And he said, sir, the pressure for me to perform is so huge. I really don't know what to do. The conventional way in which I do might not get me the results. Mm-hmm. I need someone who can actually guide me. In a way, the coaching has become essential more than teaching them. I mean, those days are over. Mm-hmm. It's like a sounding board service. Mm-hmm. I have a few thoughts. Would you mind just checking out if these thoughts would actually translate into success based on the work that you have done elsewhere? And nobody really today wants to bite the bullet and still be sure of falling into the trap of failing. Mm. They want to be successful from the first day. If you look at the IPL, where the mental conditioning comes in, right from first ball, you know, yesterday there was a match and there was a debutant who had to score at like 12 runs per over. That was asking rate. And he's just making the first appearance for India. Imagine the kind of pressure they have. Mm. Right from the day go, from like a calf which jumps out of the mother's womb and it has to run for it to escape the predators. The work that a person has to do today has a component. What you had 5 years of time, those in the past 20, 30 years ago, today maybe you have just about 3 months, a quarter max for you to show and perform. Hence, people don't mind actually getting a coach for whatever aspect of life or business. Mm. And hence, coaching today has almost become a default standard across the corporate world, at least, and that too, even in MSMEs.
Fascinating. So, Prakash, when I was reading about you, I was fascinated by the term success coach. And you've just told me something new, which I didn't know, that there are seven types of coaching. Isn't all coaching done with the objective of achieving success?
Yeah, actually, even the word success, if you really look at it, Mr. Ashutosh, is seen differently for different people. Mm. If you look at just the fundamental two aspects of success, there is one, I would call it as ambition. The second is called as aspiration. Ambition is all about results and acquiring things like, I want to increase my top line by 200% in 2 years. I want to increase my PAT by 40% in the next 2 years, whatever. Or I want to acquire an asset, or I want to take over a company, things like that. Ambitious goals also has one way of success, but the majority of the top level crowd today is moving to what I would call as aspirational success. Mm-hmm. Aspirational success is not about output, but it's about outcome, the impact, the legacy that you want to leave behind. People now are slowly understanding that making money and just increasing the bank balance of either you or your staff is not the only way to measure success. Mm-hmm. So aspiration today is overshadowing ambition. If you really look at the last 50 years history of India, you might only recall a few individuals like Dr. Abdul Kalam, maybe Pandit Nehru, or maybe our own current Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, or Mahatma Gandhi. None of them were known for the riches that they have garnered, but for the aspiration that they set and raised the level of thinking or the consciousness of the population of India. And hence, really speaking, success actually is only a catchphrase to make people to understand that there is something that they need to work to move upwards and outwards. It's like a 360 degree growth. They need to define which part of the 360 degree they want to focus and based on which the actual coaching happens.
Fascinating. And you also speak about a holistic and spiritual leadership approach. For my viewers and listeners, tell us what you mean and how do you go about this?
Yeah, the entire stuff is based on my entire life, which actually came out as a book in April. The pandemic gave me a lot of time to think and reflect upon my life and write it as a book, the book called The Spiritual CEO, which got published, bought over by Amazon Worldwide and got published recently. It has become a bestseller. Mm-hmm. It's about bringing the balance, which is badly missing in our lives. If you really look at it, at the beginning of the life, even I am very sure you would have gone through the various motivation theories, including the likes of Abraham Maslow, where the survival needs at the lowest level is only a portion of a person's life. Mm-hmm. After that, the emotional needs, the self-esteem needs takes over, and then the need to self-actualize and allow our entire ability to unfold into this world takes over. Mm-hmm. I remember a conversation from the book, Conversations with God, where the person who is apparently talking to God, I think it was Neil Nash or somebody, which came over 25 years ago, he speaks about the conversation he has with God, where God says there's no harm in making money. But more than the money that you make, how would you look at using this money to make the world a better place? In a very simple sense, the spiritual side of a person is about not just himself garnering all the output of the work that they put in. But it is about creating an impact. Here, spirituality, I don't want to confine just to the four walls of a religion. You know, many people immediately mistake. The moment you say spiritual CEO, they say, no, I am not a religious person. I don't believe in God or things like that. Or my religion doesn't allow. It's just not about just looking for God or things like that. That may be there at the other end, other spectrum of spirituality. But whatever 30 years of heartfulness meditation I had, including exposure to two great living masters of the world, not many people might know the kind of work that these people do silently. What I understood is that finally touching people's life in a way where they are peaceful, they are happy, and they have a growth in which they feel inclusive becomes a necessity. So there are three pillars to the spiritual, real holistic approach. What I would call as being peaceful, being happy, and growing to ensure that all that you are capable of actually gets unfolded in this world. If you look at some of the indexes which today have become quite famous, like the Great Places to Work, they all focus less than 10% on the material well-being of the employee. They look at almost 80 to 90% on how do you feel? Does this place allow you to be creative? Do they give you the freedom to learn and grow and things like that? And these are the things which cannot be confined just to the material aspects of life about acquiring bank assets or balance or a fancy car or a home or things like that. When I've interacted with thousands and thousands of CEOs and executives whom I have personally coached and continue to coach in the last close to 40 years, at some point of time, they all come back and say that our life is sort of shallow or empty, Prakash. Is there something that we can do? And spirituality, in a very short sense, can also be about finding the true purpose of your life. The real northern compass, that north star that you're able to set. And that's where the holistic life really comes. It's just not about confined to religion or about a specific godly belief. It is about ensuring that you are able to unfold all the capabilities that you have inside of you, which are just beyond the materialistic realms. In short, but of course, I would love if viewers get their hands on the book, on this book, The Spiritual Sea, which is really doing well. And they will get an idea. I'm just putting it in about 3 to 4 minutes of what that entire 1 year work book is about.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And this book is available on Amazon.
Yeah, they can search for The Spiritual CEO. It's available both as a Kindle version, and it's available across all the markets as hard copies as well, right from USA to Europe to Japan, China, anywhere.
Wonderful. So moving on, you know, Prakash, you have worked with a lot of entrepreneurs. I'd like to understand from you, what are some of the challenges entrepreneurs face? And it'll be great if you can give me one or two anecdotes without names.
Yeah, sure. If you really look at it, you know, many of the entrepreneurs I work with, when I get initially close to them, it's all about business. They initially sort of have what I would call as smoke screens, which comes through saying that, you know, we are not doing great compared to the capital we have invested. We aren't doing all that well compared to the stocks we are holding, the standard stuff like that. Once you get close to them, we find, I have found personally, and that's exactly what actually made me focus more and more on coaching, which seems to be more working at the root cause level instead of working at a symptomatic level. Less than 10%, the famous 10 bar 90 principle, you know, the golden principle, less than 10% of what they actually do pertains to business. 90% of the time, it's all about managing people, managing their emotions. The man as an emotional being is a very complex person. Every minute the emotions change, and the person who commits something in the morning doesn't do it in the evening, even at a senior level.
Correct.
And many of the entrepreneurs, I was recently working with a very big retail showroom. And the biggest challenge was that some of the top people were not being above board with the chairman of the group, which I was able to find out, but he wasn't able to digest it. He said, I am paying them, this is their role, why can't they do it? And it took almost 3 to 6 months, though I'm summarizing the whole thing in about 2-3 statements. It took him about 3 to 6 months to realize that they had certain hidden agenda or hidden desires, which the chairman of the group was not allowing to unfold. And that actually was taking more and more time, because every time he convened a meeting, and he all thought that everything was going to be business-like. But nothing was happening like that, because they were wanting him to handle their emotions, whereas he was handling numbers. He was going from a P&L and balance sheet perspective, and they are coming from an emotional intelligence and spiritual quotient perspective. After about 3 to 6 months, when this riddle was partly solved, then the true coaching started with him, and we set aside all the P&L and balance sheet metrics and moved on to how to handle people, how to touch their heart at a very close way, how to become compassionate, how to actually listen. And that actually created the turnaround in that organization. It took about 1.5 years finally, but today they're a very happy group. And many of those top people, some of them, of course, have migrated and gone elsewhere. And they do actually carry those learning, because it was just not meant for the chairman of the group, but even the people who are part of it took it with them and went. And they found out that 90% even of their life actually revolves around handling themselves, handling their emotions and the past baggages and stuff like that. And this actually I found to be fascinating, because when you handle that effectively, the business actually seems to take care of itself. Business becomes incidental. The famous quote of one of the companies, like, we also make steel, actually is true in a real sense in almost all the companies I worked with, Mr. Ashutosh.
Fascinating. So let's now move on and talk a little bit about the new and young generation of people who are coming into the corporate world, into the workforce, who I believe are going to change the world in a much better way than what my generation is leaving behind. How is the workplace preparing for millennials and Gen Zs? Because there's a big perception gap between the older managers and the younger ones.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question because I need to dive deeper into this on two or three different aspects because I've done a lot of work on this area. Mm-hmm. I have one at home. My daughter is about 25 years. She's a CPA. She works one of the 8 biggies, as you call. Mm-hmm. And I have someone with whom I can actually bounce ideas and check. And she's quite candid in telling bluntly on my face, being a father, it's much easier. In short, in terms of the basic expectations, which the older generation find it difficult to accept. The first point they openly say is that we want a culture, work culture, which is completely transparent and open. If you just rewind our own lives, go back to 20 years, when did we ever find a manager or a leader who was transparent, open to us? It was a one-way communication, command and control approach. Absolutely. You are told and you are supposed to do. Mm. These people are blunt and open. If you don't allow a transparent, open culture, I'm sorry, I'm quitting. Mm. If I don't get work, it's fine. I live out of a bag, travel, do some volunteer work, blah, blah, whatever. Mm. The second point they say is flexibility. You tell us what is the expectation, but leave the chance of how we want to do to ourselves. If you look at some of the very big corporations like Google, they have adopted this practice seriously. They don't tell you how to do it. They just say, okay, these are the possible areas that you can work with us. What would you like to pick? And they give the choice or the chance for the Gen Z to pick it up and then be flexible to allow them to do what they want.
Correct.
Whether you work for 1 hour, 5 hours, 10 hours, we don't care. You do what you want. We are not going to interfere. You make your own work hours. You make your own work schedule. They're quite happy with that. Many organizations haven't yet opened up to this. Mm. And more than anything else, I have found two more aspects. One is they want absolute space for having candid and open conversation, not disrespectful conversations. Mm. But they want room. If I want to talk to my manager, I want to be able to take the phone. Hey, I mean, the words that they use can be shocking to some of the older generations. Mm-hmm. They call you by first name. They call you, hey, guy, what are you doing? Types in WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. If you are not able to digest that, you haven't understood Gen Z. They don't mean any disrespect. Mm-hmm. So they are. More than anything else, they want to be allowed a space for creativity. Mm-hmm. This generation is extremely creative because of the amount of inputs that they have got mm-hmm. in less than 5 to 10 years of their educational life, which we maybe didn't get even in 40 to 50 years. Mm-hmm. They want a creative space to be preserved. This is one bucket which I found, which is essential. The second bucket, which I'm going to share, may not exactly be something that is scientifically proven today. Mm-hmm. But if you look at some of the work from the mid-90s in USA, mm-hmm. they've gone and worked in finding and mapping the DNA of the so-called the millennials and then the 2K or the Y2K Gen Z, as you would call. They found out that unlike the DNA, the dual strand mapping that we all have who were born before 85, they found surprisingly that these people, they have multiple DNA strands open. Mm-hmm. And they even call them as the purple kids or the pink kids or whatever you want to call. Mm-hmm. And they found out that their way of thinking is completely different. It's like as compared to us running in a 2-lane traffic. Mm. They have about 16 lanes or 8 lanes open. Mm. They have more channels to choose, better ways to process. Mm. They seem to look at things in a completely different way, though they may not be able to express, or even if they express, we don't connect. Mm. This DNA differentiation is becoming more and more pronounced. A lot of researchers are coming out, though the data is still not there, mm-hmm. where you can formulate a theory. Mm-hmm. But what they have found out is that this generation's DNA works completely differently, and they're working beyond dual strands. Mm-hmm. This is something which may not today be accepted. At least 3 to 5 years from now, I'm very sure, in corporate boardroom, this is a topic which will have to become part of the discussion. Mm-hmm. What is your DNA? It's just not about culture. It's about actual DNA split. And how the DNA mutation is happening in the younger kids is a fascinating subject.
Wonderful.
If you're able to mix both of this, we'll get a good grasp of what the current generation is about.
Very interesting. So, Prakash, I have time for two more questions. We've been speaking about all the positives that the millennials and the Gen Z are bringing into the workplace. Since you've done so much work with them, what are some of the vulnerabilities they bring to the workplace?
The vulnerability, I would put it mainly in two buckets, Mr. Ashutosh. First is, what is their strength, is their weakness. Mm-hmm. In the sense, the current access to information, thanks to social media, has exposed them to so much of information, and they really don't know what to do with that information. Mm. If you really look at one or two generations, each generation is about 20 years ahead or behind, you'll find that information was actually filtered and given to us.
Mm.
It was not just like that given. I mean, a taboo topic like sex education today, which is easily being spoken, you can't even mention about it. Mm. And it was being given in doses. Whether it was right or wrong, we don't know. The current generation, what is happening is they're getting too much too fast.
Mm.
And that is creating too much of discontentment inside them, because they really don't know what to do with so much of information. They're flooded with too much. The second bucket is which something again arises out of the social media,
mm-hmm.
is that they seem to have everything at a very early age, very, very early age. Maybe you and I don't know about you, at least I had to struggle hard to earn whatever I earned. It was not given to me in a silver spoon ever.
Mm.
Whereas this generation seems to have everything just like that being. Even if you look, track some of the big VAP cases which are flooding the news these days, these kids, without blaming them, are being flooded with so much of possibilities, including drugs and early sex and what I want to call. They just don't, they get confused and they think it is the way of life. And once that support system of parents are removed, they just like that fall like, as they say, linchpin, no? They just fall off. They don't really know what to do. In a nutshell, too much too early and too much exposure to social media, in a way, what we ourselves have created, are two major issues they are grappling, which is actually coming out as depression, mental disorders, and indiscipline, aggression. They are all symptoms. But in my view, predominantly, it's too much exposure too fast for these kids.
Mm.
If we are able to find a way in which we can sort of give it to them at the right dosage at the right time, we may be doing a lot of favor to the kids, but I don't know if the parents are ready these days, because the kids, at least in the last 5 years, seems to have overtaken their parents for the last 5 years. Let's see how it pans out.
Wonderful. And my last question to you is going to draw upon what you have just spoken about, the amazing strengths they bring and some of the vulnerabilities they face. What would you say coaching can do for the young people in organizations? How should coaching set up the young people in the workplace?
See, coaching predominantly for at least the earlier generation, Mr. Ashutosh, has been seen as sharing your experience with them.
Okay.
And telling them what I would call in the younger kids' words as gyan.
Mm-hmm.
This generation works completely opposite. They don't want any gyan, they don't want any unsolicited advice, almost zero talk if possible. They just want two aspects out of my own experience I'm sharing. They want you to be able to listen without any prejudices, and they want to be compassionate to their mistakes. They're ready to change. I know of many kids whom I have interacted with in my own family circle, social circles. I work with a lot of part of my heart and goodness movement, we work with a lot of colleges and schools.
Mm-hmm.
They all have tremendous amount of potential, but they believe that because of their ability to think differently or work differently, people don't listen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they shut themselves off. And that listening can happen only with compassion. So today's coaching, if you're looking at coaching anyone in the 15 to 20 category, age-wise, better stop giving yarn or lectures about, I have been there, I have done it. Get to their level, listen and be compassionate. Once they pour out, when the vessel is empty, they'll be ready to take up whatever little bit of knowledge or wisdom you're ready to share.
Fascinating. You know, on that note, I mean, it's almost as if you're saying that we should not be talking about, you know, when I was young, I used to go to school on a cycle, or I used to work, you know, and I've seen this very often you're so right in saying that don't try and pontificate to them and don't try and give opinions, listen to them. But Prakash, on that note, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for talking to me at length on coaching and your vast experience of working with millennials. Thank you for sharing with me how we can work with them much closer. Thank you again.
Thanks a lot. And I really wish all the viewers are watching this that whatever little bit of probing question that Mr. Ashutosh shared in the answer that I've been given would resonate with you. Please feel free to get in touch with any of us for any further support you need. I look at making a social impact in a big way. So thanks a lot for this great opportunity and for this platform.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the Brand Called You.